This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. No country may be more important to the United States at this moment than Pakistan. It provides both the crucial supply lines to support the war in Afghanistan and the sanctuaries used by the Taliban to train their forces and launch attacks across the border. U.S. officials are convinced that Pakistan is home to both Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, and Osama bin Laden. A fragile civilian government faces a growing threat from the Pakistani Taliban. The powerful military operates outside civilian control, and in the country's 60-year history, generals have repeatedly seized power. Pakistan's fought several wars with its much larger neighbor, India, and since both countries acquired nuclear weapons, they've both engaged in a simmering proxy war that revolves around the disputed territory of Kashmir. It may be the single most important U.S. ally in the war on terror, and maybe its biggest single problem. It's also a dynamic society of over 170 million people, second only to Indonesia in the Islamic world, with a developing economy that includes both innovative industries and businesses and wide areas of widespread poverty and illiteracy. NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel joins us here in Studio 3A today as we welcome former president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf. If you have questions for him, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. President Musharraf joins us now from the studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED. And welcome, sir, to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure being here.
Well, as you know, Mr. President, President Obama is meeting with senior advisors to reconsider U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. If he called you and asked for your advice, what would you tell him?
Well, if he does call me, I'll advise him to take the decision with due deliberation. It's a critical decision. It will have far-reaching impact on Afghanistan, on the region, and the world indeed. Therefore, whatever decision he takes, we must make sure that it is the correct decision.
And as you know, there's a debate between those who say it should be a counterinsurgency operation, injecting as many as 40,000 more U.S. forces, or maybe a counterterrorism strategy that would be simply targeted on breaking up al-Qaeda and leaving the Afghan government to its own resources.
Well, you can't isolate the two. They have very strong linkages. As far as addition of troops are concerned, I'm reading about General McChrystal's demand for 40,000 additional troops purely from military point of view. My view is I totally support General McChrystal's point of view, because at the moment what is said in military terms, the U.S. and coalition forces are diluted in space in Afghanistan. Space is large and troops are less. Therefore, purely from military point of view, his demand of additional troops is absolutely genuine. But when you are talking of differentiating between anti-terrorism and anti-insurgency, I don't know how can you isolate the two? They have linkages. Therefore, you cannot isolate the two. Both, when you are talking of anti-terrorism, you are talking of al-Qaeda, and then anti-insurgency, probably you are meaning the Taliban. Now, Taliban and al-Qaeda have certain linkages. You cannot isolate the two, that you defeat one and you think everything is going to be settled on the other side. They have developed linkages, and each one has implication on the other.
Both organizations, of course, exist on both sides of the border, in Afghanistan, yes, and in Pakistan as well. At the moment, the Pakistani army appears to be lining up for an offensive in South Waziristan, one of the tribal areas where the Pakistani Taliban and indeed the Taliban overall seems to have one of its strongholds. Are they pursuing a wise course, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Taliban is not a monolith. It is not an element which is headed by one person, and there is a defense line which can be attacked and destroyed and that one individual eliminated. It is multifaceted. The people in South Waziristan, followers of Baitullah Masood, called themselves Taliban. There are people in North Waziristan or followers of Mr. Mullah Nazir. They also call themselves Taliban. If you go to Swat, there is one Fazlullah who heads TTP. He calls himself Taliban. Sufi Muhammad of TNSM calls himself Taliban. So therefore, what we've got really is spread out elements under command of different individuals, maybe having linkages in between, but not under one head, all calling themselves Taliban. So the best strategy is to, instead of using force, dissipating your force, dealing with all of them simultaneously, the better strategy is to concentrate force and deal with one at a time. And that is what has happened in Swat. They've been defeated. And also in the neighboring Bajor and Momand agencies, they've been defeated. Now, their concentration on South Waziristan with all the force that they have is very correct strategy. It, in military terms, it is concentration of force and defeating the enemy piecemeal. That's the correct strategy.
Mr. President, this is Ted Koppel. Let me ask, how are you? It's
very good. Nice to talk
to you again.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Let me raise with you a couple of issues about strategy, and let me suggest to you that the national interest of the United States and the national interest of Pakistan may not converge as much, perhaps, as we would like to believe. That what is rarely said about U.S. interests in the region is that we are terribly concerned that Pakistan's nuclear bombs, perhaps as many as 80 or 100 of the warheads, could fall into the hands of Islamic fundamentalists. And therefore, Pakistan is concerned that the United States may at some time or another try to do something to make sure that those bombs do not fall into unfriendly hands. And Pakistan's interest, of course, has more to do with the danger that it perceives from its giant neighbor, India. How do you reconcile those two different interests?
Yeah, I would like to comment on that. First of all, I would like to make a general comment because you started with Pakistan having common concerns in the area. I keep hearing that Pakistan is the most important ally, but may I suggest, while we are the most important ally, but this most important ally is not being is being treated with suspicion. I don't think that is the right way of dealing with the most important ally. So therefore, first of all, this element has to be corrected. That if we are the most important ally and we have to cooperate, we must be treated with trust and cooperation. All right. Now, coming to your question, Ted, this nuclear concern, yes, indeed, I know about the world's concern. But let me say that we instituted custodial controls back in 2000, where we created an arrangement according to the best practices of the world. We created a national command authority on top, headed by the president, the deputy chairman is the prime minister, and there are all the military men and civilian ministers, important ones, members. This is the body which controls the development and employment. Then they have a huge secretariat, which I created back in 2000 again, called the Strategic Planning Division, headed by a three-star general. This controls all the security, the finances and the developmental aspects on behalf of that national command authority. Then holding of these assets, which is causing concern to the people of the world and to United States, we created a force called Army Strategic Force Command. This is a core level force of the army, a core of the army, meaning about 16 to 18,000 troops, manpower. And this corps has two divisions. Each division has brigades. Brigades has regiments who hold these assets with them. Therefore, now, the only way that this can fall into terrorist hands is if these terrorists can organize themselves to defeat the army, fight the army, defeat it, and take over those assets, which is not a possibility. So therefore, they are in very safe hands. And also politically, Pakistan cannot, in the foreseeable future, can never be ruled by an extremist religious group which has sympathy with extremists or terrorists. Therefore, they cannot fall into terrorist hands. But you've also raised this concern about the split of Pakistan's security interest, one against Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Certainly, at the moment, the most greatest danger to Pakistan is from the terrorist and from Al-Qaeda and Taliban. But however, having said that, we have an external threat. this external threat has existed right from 1947, and that comes from our eastern border, because this, I don't think they have fully reconciled with the presence or creation of Pakistan. Therefore, there is an existential threat to Pakistan. It is in the form of major forces, 3/4 of Indian Army and Air Force deployed, oriented entirely towards Pakistan border. This cannot be overlooked. This existential threat exists. Therefore, Pakistan always considers the total gambit of threat perception, whether it's from India or from Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and distributes forces wherever the threat is more. If the threat is more now towards Taliban and Al-Qaeda, certainly forces are being used there. But if tomorrow a threat develops from the eastern side, and there are noises coming that we should be punished or we should be attacked and there should be surgical strikes, certainly Pakistan will counter with whatever force it has to counter this threat coming from the east.
Let me jump in for a moment, Mr. President, because you talk about the need for confidence building on both sides, trust on both sides. I've spoken to a number of political leaders in this country and military leaders in this country, all of whom say the same thing, and that is, when it comes to really being given a clear understanding of where Pakistan's nuclear weapons are, how they are protected, what safeguards have been put into place, they feel that Pakistan has not been forthcoming.
And I'm going to have to ask you to answer that in just a few seconds, because we have to go to a break.
Well, I've given the entire answer in that long answer that I gave. I strongly believe that these are the best custodial controls which we have adopted from whatever international best practices that we know of, and whatever I've shown you, told you about.
We're talking today with Pervez Musharraf, former president of Pakistan. Still to come, more questions about nuclear weapons, the standoff with India, tensions with the U.S., and why the president now lives in London and not Islamabad. We're joined by NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel. If you have questions for President Musharraf, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest this hour is Pervez Musharraf, former president of Pakistan. If you'd like to speak with him about the war in Afghanistan, relations with the U.S. and India, about al-Qaeda, nuclear weapons, or other issues, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel is also with us. One of the last crises of President Musharraf's government was the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, the popular former prime minister. There are all kinds of theories about what happened. Many, including President Musharraf, blamed terrorists. Others pointed to rivals within her own party. Still others that the government either did it or knew about it. So, President Musharraf, at this distance, what do you think happened to Benazir Bhutto?
Well, she got assassinated by, and we know by whom, and that was the person who's been killed, Bathula Masood.
And he's been killed by American drone attacks?
Yes.
And the rumors that the government had anything to do with it or knew about it in advance?
These are not rumors, but created rumors, created misperceptions with ill intentions.
All right, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We'll begin with Niloufer. Niloufer with us from Statesville in Georgia.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. President, I'm a Pakistani-American. Assalamu alaikum. First of all, I would like to say that a very large number of Pakistanis, including my whole family and friends, we did appreciate and strongly support you when you were in power. We recognized that after a long time, the country had a leader who was honest and sincere, and we very much hope that you will return one day soon as the country's elected leader. My question pertains to the madrasas, which are commonly regarded as the breeding grounds of the Taliban, most of them anyway. I believe that at the time you were in power, you had a plan of getting the madrasas to adopt a more liberal curriculum, teaching the arts and sciences, along with a small component of religious education. My question is this: were you able to make any headway in this direction? And would you agree that changing the nature of the madrasas might be the most effective strategy to fight the Taliban.
Thank you very much. And first of all, let me thank you for all the compliments you've given and for the feelings about my performance in Pakistan and doing good to Pakistan and then wanting me to get back. Well, that getting back is the issue of my the support that the people of Pakistan will give me, and that includes you.
Yes,
so therefore, I'm glad that you are supporting me at least.
Yes.
So that is very encouraging. Now, let me come to your question about the madrasas. Yes, indeed, we had adopted a madrasa strategy because that was actually in a larger context. It was to do with curbing domestic extremism in our society. And one of the elements of that was to reform the madrasas. And within madrasas, the elements involved were, first of all, get rid of all foreigners, and which we have done, 90% success. The other was registering all madrasas. Again, we met a lot of success. Most of the madrasas stand registered. However, the third element, that is mainstreaming of the students. That is what you've spoken about. My idea was to maximize their potential, which is they act as an NGO for the poorest of the poor. They give free board and lodge. So we need to maximize this, but and encourage them to take over, instead of teaching only Islamic studies, also teach them board subjects, all the subjects that normal schools teach, thereby mainstreaming these Taliban so that they can adopt any other profession than being just a Maulvi sitting in a mosque. That was the idea. We were proceeding. They had agreed to adopt all this syllabus of the various boards. But where we got stuck was who is to set those papers, who's to correct those papers, is this going to be a common board doing that? We got stuck there and we didn't proceed any further, frankly. So therefore, that is the issue where we got stuck, and we need to further move again on this line. But however, let me tell you that madrasa's students are not even maybe about 5% of the total students of Pakistan. So it shouldn't be misperceived here in the West that probably all students in madrasas, generally youngsters in madrasas are products of, youngsters in Pakistan are products of madrasas.
Well,
only 5% are products of madrasas.
Let me just follow up on something Niloufer referred to. Do you plan to return to your country to resume your political career?
As I said, I'm at the moment on lecture circuits, and I'm disturbed about whatever is happening in Pakistan, back in my country. It depends on the people of Pakistan, whether, because if I come, I have to come through the election process, through the democratic process, and therefore it is the support of the people which one looks forward to. I need to have a correct evaluation of that, and also whether I think I can deliver again to Pakistan. So my decision to return will be based on these two elements.
Let me read between the lines there for a moment, Mr. President. It sounds to me as though you may have some concerns, perhaps even fears, about returning to Pakistan in the absence of having been elected to office again. Would that be accurate?
No, in the absence of being elected to office, no, not at all. Obviously, if I go back, I have to be elected through the election process.
No. I mean, when you talk about going back, I'm simply asking, are you planning to return to Pakistan? I understand that you're on a lecture tour, but
yeah,
that will end one of these days. Are you concerned about your safety?
Well, safety is certainly a danger. I have been attacked in the past, but as they say, no risk, no gain. So risks have to be taken in life, and I've faced many risks. I don't mind, for the sake of the country, risking it again. As it is, when I passed out from the military academy, I took an oath that I will go by wherever the government orders. I will go by land, air, or sea at the risk of my life, at the peril of my life. So I've taken that oath back in the academy. I don't mind risking myself.
Niloufer, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and to you and to the president for answering my question. And again, I do hope he will return.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Michael in Belleville, Illinois. Mr. Musharraf, you, unlike your predecessors, ruled Pakistan more like a civilian than a military man. My question is about ISI, that's the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency, very powerful inside Pakistan, and terror groups in Pakistan.
The emailer writes, it is well known that ISI, not under the control of the military or the Pakistani government, created all the terrorist groups such as the Taliban, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and others mainly to cause trouble in the neighboring countries. Did it ever occur to the Pakistani government that these terror groups will one day turn against Pakistan, as they are doing now? If you were aware of this fact, did you do anything to rein in ISI, or are they beyond control?
Not at all. I think these are accusations against ISI by people who don't understand ISI, and also maybe by elements who know that if you want to weaken Pakistan army and its ISI, that is how you can absolutely weaken Pakistan, because that they happen to be the army happens to be the center of gravity of Pakistan. So I don't agree with this at all. I've watched ISI. I was the army chief and then the president and the chief executive. ISI delivers exactly what the government orders them to do. Now, when we are in the 90s, if any accusation that ISI created Lashkar-e-Tayyaba, etc., is absolutely baseless. In 1989, a freedom struggle started in Kashmir. And this had great public sympathy in every individual of Pakistan. Man walking on the streets, they had public sympathy. And therefore, dozens of Mujahideen groups, dozens of them, got created by themselves, and they were prepared to go across into Kashmir and fight with their brethren in Kashmir against the Indian army. These were self-created. It was the public sympathy that got aroused, and we went across. The only thing that I would like to say, certainly maybe the governments at that time were turning a blind eye towards them because they wanted India to come on the negotiating table to discuss and resolve the Kashmir dispute. They are not the creation of ISI. ISI in that period of 12 years from 1989 for the 20 years is doing exactly what the government is ordering them to do. And they have been doing that in the past since 1979 also, or even beyond in the earlier parts of our after we got created. Do whatever government orders them to do.
Can we talk for a moment, Mr. President, about the U.S. aid package that has been proposed and has apparently caused some considerable upset, particularly among the Pakistani military? Simply put, the United States is proposing to give Pakistan, I believe it's $1.6 billion a year over a five-year package, and has had the audacity to suggest that perhaps Pakistan ought to be accountable as to how this money is spent and that there be some oversight. And this has been seen in Pakistan, particularly, as I say again, by the military, as suggesting excessive American intrusiveness in internal Pakistani affairs. Would you comment on that?
I agree with the Pakistan Army totally that this is unnecessary intrusion, interference in micromanagement of issues of Pakistan as a sovereign country. If you want to give aid to Pakistan, if you consider Pakistan to be the most important ally, treat it importantly. Don't have suspicions with Pakistan. Having said that, now we are talking of $1.5 billion that are going to be given, and we are talking of in the past when I was accused that $3 billion, $2.5 billion over 5 years, which means $500 million a year were given. Now, if we think that this is the only amount that Pakistan has for the military or the socio-economic sector, whichever sector this money goes to, we are mistaken. This forms a part of a huge kitty that Pakistan itself from its own exchequer uses, whether in the socio-economic sector or the military sector. Military certainly needs much more than whatever is given to them from the United States, and that is being done by the exchequer of Pakistan. If I give you a rough assessment, Pakistan gets $1.5 billion annually from remittances alone of Pakistanis from abroad. Pakistan gets $7 billion. So if we think it is just this $1.5 billion which will be misused by Pakistan, that is not the case. Pakistan has a fairly large economy. It's a big country. It needs much more resources than what United States gives it. So therefore now, talking of its being misused, this adds to the kitty which Pakistan already allocates to the various sectors. And it shouldn't be taken that it is only this amount that is Pakistan uses for the military or socio-economic. Certainly the amount given is used,
Mr. President,
correctly in wherever it is required to be used.
With respect, there's been a pretty well-documented fact that previous American aid intended for use against the in the west of the country, against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, was in fact diverted to the east and the Indian side.
Not at all. I don't agree with that at all. This is, again, a statement which lacks understanding of our environment. The money was used against the Taliban. But, however, as I said, I will repeat, if we think that this is the only the money, $500 million a year we are talking of,
mm-hmm.
if we think that it is only $500 million used by 150,000 troops being deployed there, their logistic support, the aircraft that are used, the tanks and the helicopter gunships and transport helicopters, the ammunition that is used, it is far, far more than $500 million. Therefore, I said it is forms the amount already given. It reinforces that amount. The other point I want to make is whatever equipment is bought from additional equipment bought from whatever we get from United States is certainly used against in the West against the Taliban and al-Qaeda, but this is held by the regiments, by the armor regiment, infantry battalion, the artillery regiment, and these regiments are not static. They move. They move from the east to the western border to the eastern border, to Kashmir or to the south. And they carry their equipment and ammunition wherever they go. Excuse they don't leave them in the mountains. But having said that, when they move out, there is another regiment which replaces them. If it is an artillery regiment
Mr.
with 18
President.
Guns and it has moved to the eastern border, another regiment of 18 guns will come there and fill their slot.
Mr.
And
President,
they bring their equipment.
Mr.
So
President,
therefore, we must understand what is happening with the equipment that we get.
We're talking with Pervez Musharraf. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Chuck. Chuck with us from San Francisco.
Thank you very much. My question follows on the last subject pretty much. As an American, not only am I concerned that our aid money gets some part of it gets siphoned off for corruption, but also given our values and our interests, I believe a shift of aid from what President Musharraf has described as the center of gravity, that is the military, to aid that might promote more democratic and good governance in Pakistan is something that I think is both in our national interest and consistent with our values. I'm interested in President Musharraf's reaction to a shift in aid of that sort.
Well, thank you very much. My answer to that, again, this suspicion of corruption, I take serious exception to anyone calling me and my government having anything to do with corruption. My pride is that during my time, myself and my government was the most honest government that is accepted by not only every Pakistani, but even the world. So therefore, there was no corruption going on. Is anyone asking that there has been $156 billion spent in Afghanistan? Is that also, has there been some corruption there also? Is anyone questioning that?
Everyone questioning believes that Afghanistan
million?
Is corrupt.
Pardon me, but if... If we assume that there is no corruption, and I'm happy to assume that for the discussion, how do you feel about shifting aid away from the military?
Yes, I was going to answer that.
And you have a minute, I'm afraid.
There is no corruption. Shifting of aid, I think Pakistan requires assistance in fighting terrorism and extremism, and Pakistan also requires assistance in the socio-economic sector, because in the long-term strategy against terrorism and extremism, it is poverty alleviation and education. And I think the United States should contribute there also. So a balanced contribution in military and socio-economic is what is required.
Chuck, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
We're talking with the former president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf. He's with us from the studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED. NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel is with us. More of your calls and emails after a short break. The number to call is 800-989-8255. Email us talk at npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, the former president of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, is our guest. We're talking about the threat of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, the future of his country, and Pakistan's often rocky relationship with the United States. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Ted Koppel, NPR senior news analyst, is also with us. Let's get another caller in. This is Ashish. Ashish calling from Lucknow in India.
Yes, greetings from Lucknow, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Yes. Before I ask my question, I'd like to say how much I appreciate the positive steps that you took to improve relations with India when you were president.
Thank you.
My question is, India and Pakistan right now see each other as enemies. Do you think in my lifetime, and I'm 40 years old, there will be a time when India and Pakistan will consider themselves good friends? And if so, what steps can India, Pakistan, and potentially the U.S. take to achieve this? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I think you've got a long life ahead of you. You're only 40. So I'm reasonable. I'm an optimist. I think there is enough time beyond within your life that we need to. In any case, we must reach peace. I mean, that is what I would like to say. We must. It is a prerequisite. It is a requirement. It's a compulsion for Pakistan and India and for the whole South Asian region. Therefore, we must reach peace. Now, the question is, how do we reach peace? There has to be sincerity on the part of leadership on both sides. There has to be a flexible approach by leadership of both sides. And there has to be boldness to be shown by leadership on both sides. Because this last element, boldness, is very essential. Because when you reach a deal, you have to give and take. It is the give part which becomes difficult. Because giving involves some backlash back in your own backyard, in your own home, in your own country, with some where some extremist elements may agitate, come on the streets. That is where boldness is required. And as long as both sides know that it is in the larger interest of both India and Pakistan, and that most vast majority will support the peace agreement, we must strike for a peace deal.
What should Pakistan give up here, and how would you sell that?
No, well, we can't get into the details, but when we are talking of the main, there are three disputes, Sir Creek, Siachen, and Kashmir. Kashmir is the most important element, and that is where both have to agree to give and take. And we were following a certain principles that, in fact, were my own brainchild. It was I who initiated the principles that we must follow a course of graduated demilitarization, giving maximum self-governance to the people of Kashmir, and having an overwatch on top to see this self-governance elements. And then we also came out with an idea of making the line of control irrelevant. So we were moving forward on these four broad principles, and that is where give and take was involved.
Let me come back for a moment to the issue of U.S.-Pakistani relations. As I'm sure you know, public opinion polls taken in Pakistan show that the Pakistani people, by and large, have a very jaundiced view of the United States. The United States is not very popular in Pakistan. And I think the American public, in turn, looks at the amount of money, and while I take your point, Mr. President, that $1.5 or $1.6 billion is not the entirety of the money that Pakistan has to deal with, it is nevertheless a considerable chunk. And the United States public does not see Pakistan showing a great deal of appreciation. Quite the contrary. America's popularity in Pakistan seems to be going down with each passing year. Can you explain that to me, please?
Well, While at the government level, there is good interaction because there is an economic relationship, there is a commercial and trade relationship between the United States and Pakistan. But at the people's level, you are right that the people of Pakistan do not have a lot of negative views about United States.
And why is that?
And yeah, it is because of exactly what we are talking even now. When we are suspecting Pakistan, when we are not conscious or we don't show concern about Pakistan's own interests, Pakistan's national interest, Pakistan's sovereignty. When we are talking of various, we read articles of violation of Pakistan's sovereignty, it has a lot of sensitivity in the people of Pakistan. Therefore, the people of Pakistan keep getting more and more away from the public opinion, gets away from United States. In any case, there is a background to it also. Till 1989, Pakistan was the strategic ally of United States. We fought a war for 10 years and defeated Soviet Union, ended the Cold War for you. Pakistan in the front ranks.
You're talking
then
about
from
in
1989 onwards.
In Afghanistan, you mean?
In Afghanistan. In 1982, it was beyond 1989 that we were totally left high and dry. We were totally abandoned. You left 25,000 Mujahideen who became Al-Qaeda, and Pakistan was to fend for itself. And then the Taliban came in, and Pakistan is all alone, 4 million refugees in Pakistan. What was United States doing for those 12 years? You imposed sanctions on Pakistan, 40 F-16s for which we had given, I think, about $650 million. Were denied to Pakistan. All this is known by the people of Pakistan. Therefore, the opinion became negative against the United States. After 42 years of strategic partnership, we were totally ditched and absolutely ignored. And therefore, after 9/11, when we decided to join the coalition, in all my press interviews, media interactions, people used to ask me, what makes you think that United States is not going to ditch us again? So these were the sentiments of the people of Pakistan.
That's a very relevant point at this time, Mr. President, when indeed our president and his top advisors are debating that very issue, not the issue of withdrawal from Afghanistan, but the issue of whether to increase troop forces by as many as 40,000 troops. And indeed, there are elements in the president's own party who would very much like him to pull out of Afghanistan altogether.
Yes, I think this is very important that we reduce this trust deficit, which is unfortunately increasing between Pakistan Army, ISI, and United States, and the two governments. We must reduce this trust deficit. We must work out strategies jointly. What do we want to do? What is the decision required now in the interest of the world, in the interest of the region? We cannot destabilize this region through a wrong decision that we take. And if I was to talk of that, and the decision that the United States government and President Obama is trying to reach, the element, one thing is very clear, that Al-Qaeda has to be defeated and destroyed in that region. That is maybe the wish of certainly Pakistan and Afghanistan also, even the Taliban may not want Al-Qaeda there at the moment. But then we have to think subsequently, one school of thought saying that once Al-Qaeda is destroyed, you leave Taliban alone because their agenda is home, agenda of controlling Afghanistan. The other is, if you leave them alone, what is the Al-Qaeda? Won't the Al-Qaeda again come back, and there won't be any support to Al-Qaeda by the Taliban? And the third element that needs to be introduced in this discussion is, even if Al-Qaeda doesn't come, what is the agenda of Taliban beyond their borders? Is it to link with the Taliban on the Pakistan side and spread Talibanization beyond even the tribal agencies of Pakistan? Having linkages with extremists in Pakistan, then going beyond that and having linkages with extremists in Kashmir or in India. So these are things which we need to look into very deeply. It's not merely anyone who thinks that Al-Qaeda can be isolated and they get defeated and everything, leave the Taliban alone, I don't think is having a very clear, holistic view of the entire situation. There are linkages between Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and then we have to also see what is the agenda of the Taliban beyond Afghanistan, if at all the forces were to quit from Afghanistan.
John is on the line calling from Minneapolis.
Yes. Hello, Selikam, Mr. President. My brother's been to your country many times. Question I have, a pleasure to talk to you. Question I have is, do you think, what research do you think will it take to apprehend and or kill Osama bin Laden and some of the other culprits behind 9/11?
Well, I can't. The resources that are being asked and demanded by General McChrystal and the resources being employed by Pakistan armed forces and the second line forces, the Frontier Corps in Frontier Province, is adequate to find and destroy him. But however, finding is the problem. Finding is the issue in those mountainous region where there is no communication infrastructure, where there is support by some segments of the society, by the people giving him safe havens, it becomes difficult to find him. Otherwise, the force is enough to destroy any terrorist element.
John, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, pleasure talking to you, sir.
All right, bye-bye. We're talking with Pervez Musharraf, former president of Pakistan, who now lives in London. He's speaking to us at the moment from the studios of our station in San Francisco, KQED, our member station there. Ted Koppel, NPR senior news analyst, with us. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And President Musharraf, you talk about a deficit of trust between Pakistan and the United States. There is... How much cooperation is there between Pakistan and the United States in the series of attacks by drone aircraft that attack Al-Qaeda, U.S. drone aircraft that attack Al-Qaeda cells in Pakistan, and now are attacking Pakistani Taliban cells in Pakistan as well?
Well, there is total cooperation on the intelligence side. There is cooperation at the strategic level. But this cooperation at the tactical operational level is more wanting, I would say. But when you are talking of cooperation on the drone attacks, there is no cooperation on that. This is a double-edged weapon. While yes, militants are hit, targets are hit, but it has tremendous negative fallout in the public of Pakistan because it is considered a violation of our sovereignty. Therefore, I have always been of the view that these drones should be given to Pakistan and let Pakistan armed forces use them in accordance with whatever targets they see.
Now, would that have to be without any assurances or without any guarantees as to where and how they will be used? Because, again, the United States government is concerned that you might choose to use them over Kashmir.
Again, we are not fighting a war in Kashmir.
Not yet.
You should not, if at all India attacks Pakistan and violates our sovereignty, why should United States grudge Pakistan to take defensive measures to protect itself, to counter the existential threat that comes from the East? This is exactly what people of Pakistan don't understand with the United States.
But if
we have been your strategic
be,
ally, and yet we have been treated suspiciously.
If there
now
is
we
to
are
be,
in the lead role to fight terrorism, extremism, again we are being treated suspiciously.
If there,
so
is, to be, if there is to be
we,
all this,
we remove this conflict.
If there is to be all this cooperation between Pakistan and the United States, and I agree it is very much in the U.S. national interest that that happen. Why is there such an objection, for example, to the United States building the huge embassy compound that it wants to build now, staffed with approximately 1,000 people? Why the objection to some of these civilian contractors coming in? If indeed that is what the U.S. government needs to help Pakistan reach some of these common goals, why the objections?
Well, again, the objection is certainly 1,000. I don't know what the United States is doing in that embassy compound. I'm not very clear. But if it means placing about over 1,000 Marines there, certainly people of Pakistan get suspicious.
You know better than that, Mr. President. It wouldn't be 1,000 Marines. If indeed the United States is going to be expending over $1 billion a year in social programs, why is it inappropriate for there to be civilian staff members, many hundreds of them, at the U.S. Embassy?
Well, yes. I mean, if there are to be civilian staff members to oversee or to even whatever assistance is given to Pakistan and to assist in that or dealing with that, well, one wouldn't, I agree, one wouldn't be so suspicious of that. But because of this trust deficit that already exists between United States and Pakistan, people don't believe this. They don't believe that it's going to be a few hundred civilians just to see, be involved in the disbursement of the assistance that United States is giving to Pakistan. The perception there is that there are going to be 1,000 Marines and they are coming there. And the more bigger suspicion is that they are coming there to maybe to be more inquisitive, intrusive in our nuclear program, which is again seen very negatively.
There is. We just have 2 minutes left with you, sir, and I wanted to follow up on one point, and that was the attack in Mumbai. Outside of Pakistan, everybody believes that this was a group based in Pakistan, which launched itself across the border in an effort to divert, perhaps, Pakistan's army to the border with India rather than to its fight against the Taliban in the western part of the country. Yet Pakistan seems to have done very little to break down this group.
Now, yes, indeed, the diversion of Pakistan military's attention to the eastern border is not because of Bombay attack. It is because of the threatening noises from India. When they come out, and they say Pakistan needs to be attacked. Let us punish Pakistan. Let us carry out surgical strikes. That is what diverts attention of Pakistan's military. It's not Bombay attack. So that is what the Indian government needs to be told, not to get hyper about terrorist attacks. And the terrorist attacks, actually the aim and purpose of the terrorist is exactly this, to divert attention from whatever is the military is involved in, and also creating a gulf between India and Pakistan, between the public of India and Pakistan, so that the peace process, which may be moving forward, is diverted, attention is diverted from that. This is what happened when the attack on the parliament took place in 2001-2. Where the Indian army was massed against our borders, and the peace process that we had initiated between myself and Prime Minister Vajpayee got totally derailed for 2 years, and we lost time. So these things should not be done, and we must not play in the hands of the terrorist.
Mr. President, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pervez Musharraf, former president of Pakistan, with us from KQED, our member station in San Francisco. NPR senior news analyst Ted Koppel, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, it's Science Friday, Talk of the Nation Science Friday. We'll be back with you again on Monday. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.